Welcome to Filmstrip. These podcasts are spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the films in review. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.
Welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Jay, and I'm happy to welcome to the show Lindsay from the Schlock and All podcast. Lindsay, thank you so much for coming on the show. Please tell folks a little bit about yourself and your fantastic podcast.
Hey, Jay. No, thanks for having me so much. This is going to be really fun. I am the host of Schlock and All, which is a double feature podcast. I try to pair all kind of weird and wonderful things together that may not make sense on first look, and then you dig into it and you can find things to connect them. That is my podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Highly recommend people check that out if they haven't already. It'll be linked in the show notes. I had a chance to be on a show recently. We had a good time talking Deja Vu and Clock Stoppers. And if you want to know how those connect, that's one way to listen to the show. But it's apropos for how things go over there. And I had to bring you over here, too, because this movie, while we're not doing a double feature, is more than meets the eye, I'll argue. We're here to talk about 13 Going on 30, starring Jennifer Garner, Judy Greer, Mark Ruffalo, Krista B. Allen, and the wonderful Andy Serkis. Directed by Gary Winnick, released in 2004 on a $37 million budget, grossed almost $100 million, $96.5 million at the box office, was a huge smash. And Jennifer Garner, to this day, still talks about like the lasting impact of this movie. But Lizzie, what was your first exposure to 13 Going on 30?
I went and saw this at the movies when it came out to around 2004, because Jennifer Garner had already been in Daredevil, if I'm not mistaken, as Elektra, which I have a soft spot for that movie. And yeah, so we just went as a big group of friends to go see this sound like a really cute sort of romantic comedy. I didn't actually know who Mark Ruffalo was at the time. So actually, I forgot that he was that when I was watching it. I'm like, oh, my God, Mark Ruffalo is the guy in it. So that was funny. But yeah, no, it was definitely a big group of us going to go to the movies to go see it back in the day now.
Yeah, I went and saw this at the theaters, too. It was one of those like, hey, we want to go to the movie. And my wife and I were just kind of flipping through, looking at things. We're like, that looks kind of funny. You know, 80s nostalgia. Sure. You know, so we went and saw it, and it really stuck with me because I thought, hey, there's a lot going on in that movie. You know, there's a whole bunch happening. And I didn't know who Ruffalo was either. I think I would see him in Collateral later that year. And he's a small part in that. And that's mostly Michael Mann and Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx doing their thing. But he's got a turn in there. And then you see all the things he's done since. And I'm not even talking about like the Avengers movies. It's just, this is not the kind of thing you would stick him in. But it's like seeing Chris Pine in like early rom-com form. You know, like I think everybody, if you have a decent look at all, they throw you in one of these things. And Jennifer Garner to me, though, was not some, I mean, I knew of her, but I hadn't seen a lot of her work. I didn't watch Alias, and I still haven't ever seen an episode of that. And I saw Daredevil, but I didn't see it in theaters, and I barely remember anything about it. It's been years since I have to go back and revisit that one someday, because it's been a long time. But I knew of her. I knew she had been in stuff. And so, but I was hyper aware of Judy Greer. I think I've seen her in stuff forever. And I knew the name Andy Serkis. I was like, oh, the mocap guy? You know, and I didn't know he looked like a real person that I'd never seen him, and then to see him in this, and he's done so many other things too. It's always nice to see him actually on screen, because I think he's so known as all these other created characters, but he certainly gives a performance. And then, you know, just, I watched this movie, and I remember walking out of it going like, there's a lot going on in that, like, what they're, it stuck with me in a way. And so, you know, caught it again, and it's been a few years, but it's just one that I've always kind of had a little, I don't know, soft spot for, because I like rom-coms anyway. The history of Filmstrip is, if you go back early in the days, like we were doing rom-coms back way long ago, like early episodes, Anna and I would do a lot of those. And I've always liked those. I'm not a big broad comedy fan, but for some reason, rom-coms have always been kind of a thing for me. So I know the formula, and when one can twist the formula a little bit and add a little, I don't know, magical element and stuff, I'm always into it. Things like Big, you know, I think that was probably one of the early ones that I saw, and people don't think that's a rom-com, but it is. And I don't know, I did something about this one stuck out. And so I remember seeing it in theaters. And like I say, I've thought about it a lot since. And back a million years ago, when I tried to have a blog and write more than talk, and before I realized that talking is a lot easier than having to write anything down, I wrote really this whole is. Like 1800 words about how 13 Going on 30 is this secret time travel movie. And I'll try to convince the audience of that tonight. We'll see if you agree with me, but it's a, it's a film that it's fun to watch these things when you see these people that have had long careers and they're not known for doing this stuff so much. And you see them get to do it in this. It's just fun to watch, you know, I guess you'd say good quality actors put on one of these things where it's not the big ensemble, you know, like Valentine's Day, or He's Just Not Into You, or one of those kind of movies.
Yeah, it really is. I would agree, because when I saw it back in 2004, I think my first thought was, I wish I was 13. And I think what I've realized with this, no, because I think I would have appreciated it more, because I was in my mid-20s, I was becoming a real big movie snob, I'd fallen out of romantic comedies. Now I'm right back in with them. I'm like, you give me a, especially a Nancy Myers or a Nicola Hofstetter, I think that's her name, but she's got a new one coming out. I'm very excited. You give me one of those movies and I am just gonna lap them up. I really love the rom-com format. So I think back in 2004, I didn't appreciate it, and I didn't appreciate especially Jennifer Garner's performance, because she was more known as action. So I heard her do this really sweet romantic comedy, and I think because of her performance and the fact that it is the secret time travel, secret monkey's wish, monkey paws, careful what you wish for, It's a Wonderful Life movie, there is a lot more going on in it. And yeah, to watch all these actors like Andy Serkis, I'm like, it's like probably like, oh, Andy Serkis thought he could have, like, was trying to be like an actor when he would all be forever known as the mocap guy because of Gollum and then Caesar in the 8 movies. And he's really good. And I'm such a grey head now. So when she popped up, I was like, yes, Judy Greer's in this. I am happy. It's Mark Ruffalo. Everyone's having fun and taking it seriously. It does actually have a, even though it's about a 13-year-old trapped in a 30-year-old's body, it does have a weird Nancy Myers quality to it, like the fantasy of living in New York, which I really, really appreciated. So I think I appreciated it way more on this watch than I did when I was becoming a massive film snob, that if it wasn't Lynch or Michael Haneke or something, you know, more that would play in a festival, I was kind of turning my nose up at a little bit. Especially the rom-com. And as I've gotten older, I'm like, no, I want that rom-com feeling. I want that trope. I just want, it's the best kind of comfort food, which this movie so is.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you hit on something there, is that I think Hollywood has used the rom-com for years as a vehicle to talk about other stuff that they didn't really have or maybe they felt like if we do the straight genre version of the time travel movie or this, it'll just kind of fly and nobody will see it. But if we couch it in this other thing, it's like putting the medicine in something else so that, you know, the dog will take it or the kid or whatever, right? It's sort of, I'm going to hide this in this other vehicle to get the point across about it. And I don't know, I've always thought that was neat, because a lot of times when you read about like the making of some of the more famous rom-coms ever, like if you think of like Pretty Woman's probably maybe the most famous romantic comedy, at least in the modern era, right? And it's one we've covered here. That movie's about a lot of stuff. I mean, it's sort of the really Cinderella story, but it's there's a lot of dark things. And if you go and like know anything about the original script, it was a lot darker. Like there was addiction and all kinds of other awful things. And Gary Marshall was like, we can't do that.
No, I'm glad we had the Pretty Woman we have, because I do love that movie. And I weirdly grew up. No, not weirdly. It was the late 80s. I grew up on that movie. But I would also like to have the actual version of the addicted, dark, doesn't get the prince at the end movie. But a lot of rom-coms, especially sort of watching this one and then going back and watching a few scenes again, a lot of rom-coms are actually about what happens when your life doesn't turn out the way you want it. And a lot of it is a fantasy. You have, they always have like amazing jobs, and they're kind of, it's especially from the modern era with Pretty Woman and a lot of modern, it's all about the woman having the, you know, can have it all. But what a lot of these movies kind of go for is that actually your life is never going to turn out the way you want it. So say something like You've Got Mail, your store's going to close. Yes, you get to be with Tom Hanks, but your life isn't going to be the way you want it. And this one has that quality. Pretty Woman definitely has that quality. I love the story of Gary Marshall telling Jennifer Jason Leigh not to be so sad in her audition, because she hasn't been doing it for that long, when she was auditioning to play the Julia Roberts role in Pretty Woman. But yeah, your life doesn't always, so yeah, when you said rom-coms have been a way to talk about sort of these very slightly more mature kind of ethereal themes and putting sugar on top of it. So yes, you do get the thing of, oh, because everyone works at a magazine or is an editor or has this really kind of amazing job. Like I love in her when you find out Joaquin Phoenix is, which I think is making a joke of it, but he writes greeting cards for a living, like some really weird thing. So, but yeah, even with all that kind of, this is the fantasy, it's always about the person's life getting completely upended, everything not turning out the way they wanted it, and then trying to settle into something else that feels more right for them instead of trying to force it, which is very much this movie. So I think you're very right about that.
Yeah. And I mean, and you know, again, these movies have when they're done right, it's when they bring a cast together that understands that, oh, there's more on this material than just what is on surface. So if they just played it straight, it would be like every other forgettable, you know, episode of Friends or 90210, right? But the fact that they know that this is a little bit more, and you, when you get people like Ruffalo and Greer in particular, and even Andy Serkis, I would say that the supporting cast in this movie understands, like, oh, here's what we've got going on, and we're going to make sure that these layers are here so that Jennifer Garner can be kind of the goofy, you know, 13-year-old as a 30-something-year-old. You know, that's the fun part of this, is watching. I think as having known a lot of actors, it's fun to watch actors get to play stuff like that and watch them try to, you know, channel it and do it. And if you go watch any of the interviews at the time, like her and Judy Greer both talk about, like, the girls that played their counterparts as teenagers are like, first off, those girls are way prettier than we were when we were there, and they're a lot smarter. I had none of that confidence when I was doing this. And they tried to sort of channel what that was like when they were in school and stuff. And it's always fun to see. And for somebody like me, to the shock of no one listening to this show, I am not a teenage girl and never was one, and so I don't know what that experience was, so I just know what it's been portrayed as in pop culture. So it's neat to see. It's having saw it with my wife, I was like, was this kind of like, you know, is this what it was like in high school? She said, people being mean to each other. Yeah, absolutely, that's totally so and I don't know, I think it's neat to get into, but I think we need to do a quick plot summary, kind of blow the plot of this, and then start picking this thing apart, because there's a lot going on. I mean, if you know the rom-com boilerplate gang, this isn't going to be a surprise, but what's going on and the way it's delivered is. So you've got Jennifer Garner playing Jenna Rink, who's your usual rom-com 13-year-old girl in 1987. And by that, I mean, she is the cut out cookie cutter nostalgia version of what 1987, what we thought it was. She likes Rick Springfield. She's obsessed with, like, a fashion magazine / advice magazine. She wants to join the cool girls club at her school called the Six Chicks, which would be a problem because she'd be the seventh, but whatever, never mind math. And she has a cute best friend who's also way cooler than the rest of the world, but everybody dismisses him and ignores him because, nah, he's, you know, he hadn't totally filled out yet. He takes photographs and he listens to weird music.
Mark Ruffalo yet. Is what happens. This is the very important moral of the story. If you're gonna fall in love with your childhood best friend, go into the future.
He will become Mark Ruffalo. So all Jenna wants to be is 30, flirty, and thriving, which is the first time a 13-year-old has ever wanted to be 30, but we'll get there. But she stood up at her birthday party by the cool girls. Her friend Matt tries to cheer her up, gifting her this custom dream house he built for her with all of her favorite stuff, including magical wish dust. And she pushes him away and wishes to be 30 that she idolizes. And of course, she wakes up the next morning in her luxurious apartment in New York. She's the co-editor of her dream magazine with one of the main six chicks, Lucy, played by the great Judy Greer, and she's exactly what she wanted to be, except she doesn't have any idea how she got there, because this is not Jennifer Garner waking up and being 30 and having done all the things it takes to get there. She's a 13-year-old transplanted into her 30-year-old across time and space. She doesn't know if any of it's real. So she learns that she and Matt stopped being friends after that birthday party, and she not only gravitated to the six chicks, she became their leader. And she uses her connections, of course, to find Matt, though, and he's still like hipster cool. He's a professional photographer who lives in an apartment in the village that no photographer on earth can ever afford, but never mind.
So that apartment is huge.
We're going to get to the real estate in a minute. But so Jenna realizes that, you know, she got everything she wanted when she was 13, but it's not all it's cracked up to be. She's kind of disconnected from her parents. Her magazine's in danger of failing. Lucy's actually conspiring against her, which we find out this Jenna was also kind of a conspiring against her own. She was tanking her own magazine to go to the rival one. And Matt's getting married to somebody else. So she reconnects with her roots, though, and by hiring Matt to shoot this big nostalgic redesign for the magazine. And she even tries to woo him from his fiance, and they have, you know, some meet cute moments. But all this, of course, totally backfires, as it has to, because Lucy steals Jenna's idea, takes it to the rival magazine. Matt goes to be married. And even after Jenna chases him, she realizes, hey, I missed my window. I just want you to be happy. And he gives her the dream house back that he found in his closet, and it's still got a little magic dust on it. So instead of being altruistic and letting things go, Jenna decides, no, I'm going to wish everything back the way I want it. She wakes him back in the closet at the 13th birthday party, chooses Matt instead of Lucy and the Six Chicks, and a montage and a pop song later reveal that they live in the same New Jersey suburb that they grew up in. They found their own version of 30 and flirty and thriving as credits roll. And we're left to wonder, is Jenna like Sam Beckett and able to jump through time, or was that a one-way trip? We'll never know, but we'll get into it as we go. But that's the plot, as it were, of 13 going on 30. I don't think it's something we need to bounce, you know, piece to piece to. It's mostly contained. And the thing about this that I really appreciated, 2006, 2007 is when we stopped allowing movies that were less than 120 minutes to be in theaters. And I forgot how easy it was to watch a movie it's 97 minutes, but it's really about 85, and just to watch it go down easy. I watched this and I was like, oh, that was so refreshing. They got an entire three acts done in that amount of time. And I appreciate the economy of the way that it's done.
No, it is really economic, and you do remind yourself, oh, this is when movies had like a solid three-act structure. They got in, they got out, they didn't really run waste away. Now, I'm not so criticizing every long movie, because I am looking forward to the new Scorsese, which I've heard is over 4 hours, and I'm like, yes, please, just deliver that to me now. But there is something about a movie being functional within its three-act structure, like kind of very well-plotted, going to each, to each, to each. And yeah, I like when everyone knows Big, and that is kind of Tom Hanks becoming Big, another, again, 30, flirty, and thriving, which I just find absolutely hilarious, because no, you're looking forward to when you're 21, not when you're 30. But yeah.
Remind everybody that Nancy in A Nightmare on Elm Street gets gray streaks in her hair and says, oh my gosh, I look like I'm 20 years old. It's the end of the world. And then they're like 30. Like, I don't know a single 13-year-old that wanted to be 30. But I can't tell you how smart that is, though. No. Because, and Taylor Tomlinson, who's a young comic who's really come on the last few years, has this whole bit about, like, you remember the nostalgia of your 20s because nobody expected anything out of you. You might have been thinner and cuter, exactly, but you were garbage. And she's not wrong. I'm like, yes, no, nobody, like, you want to be your 20s, but truthfully, your 20s suck. Like, you don't know anything, but you're not responsible for things. Yeah.
I would not want to go back to my 20s. I would go back to my 30s. No,
that'd be like going back to middle school.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you weren't responsible for anything. You didn't have, if you missed bills, they'd just go, well, okay, you're 20. The thing I love about Big is that he just grows up, and then his poor mother has to deal with this grown man in his son's bed. When you watch the movie, it's like, oh, okay. And this one, she's actually going through time, and she doesn't, all she knows is that she now has a life that she dreamed about when she was 13. Like, even when I was a kid, I wait to move to a bigger city. I couldn't wait to get a career, have a job, kind of living on your own. That was kind of what I was excited about. So I do get that element of when you're turning 13, when you're kind of now a teenager, but you're still too young to be a teenager. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Judy Greer's crew to just spot the baby Brie Larson, though. Mm-hmm. She's tiny. You're kind of starting to go, oh, what does it mean to actually be older and everything like that? But you're still 13, so you're still considered a child in a lot of ways. So I kind of get that dynamic. But yeah, I'm just like, no, I didn't really want to be, I didn't think about what apartment I'd be living in New York, or kind of, like, when I was watching the movie, I thought it would be fascinating to look at kind of Jenna having to deal with actual responsibility, because she doesn't really have to deal with any responsibility, I mean, in the movie. So what would happen if she found out that she owed money, like she had a massive credit card debt, or something that happens when you're in your 30s that you have to kind of go, oh, I am now responsible for this, which the movie doesn't do. And I'm putting something that the movie has no interest in, but I was like, oh, what would happen if a 13-year-old suddenly realize that her credit is in the toilet.
Like, right. I have to pay rent. You know, like, that's what I love about this show, is that they gloss over enough of like the adult things she has to do. Like, she reads a book on like magazine publishing for dummies. Like, it's kind of a joke. But what you realize is that, and you called it out early on, it's very much like It's a Wonderful Life. It's her idealized version of what she thinks her life should be like because of this magazine called Poise that she's obsessed with and she ultimately goes to work for. And she, you know, it's what she has built up in her head is like, this is what my life should be like when I'm 30. I'm going to do all these things. And so the thing I posit about this is that none of what we see is real. The only things that we see that are real is that is the party, the kids at the beginning, all of that stuff. And then the very end, like that she has this whole time travel experience. And maybe she just got a concussion banging her head against the bookshelf where she sprinkles the magic dust on herself. But I don't think any of what we see actually happens.
Eyelids aren't feeling that way. So it's kind of, like, be careful what you wish for. Like, the guy who really wants just to be able to read and be away from his nagging wife. And this happens, and then he breaks his glasses. I mean, it's that very much that kind of, that very much that kind of thing. And, and yeah, so you're not, I'm watching this as when I was younger, into my 20s, when I didn't have any responsibilities, I was kind of like, oh, that's cute. Now I'm looking back and going, oh, no, Jim is going to have has a lot more responsibility. And also, why is these movies children always end up running companies really well?
Right. Well, you know, but that's the thing is, again, it's this is a complete fantasy. And I think if you accept this movie on that level, like unlike Big, where we're supposed to believe that the Zoltar machine actually makes Josh the end of the big Tom Hanks and he goes and lives that life because it's so tactile and real and he's so scared and everything. This is a complete fantasy. And it plays it so much lighter. And you could dismiss it as going like, oh, this movie's just kind of light. But when you start, again, better actors, and they start digging into the surface of it, you go like, oh, this is It's a Wonderful Life, but from a teenage girl's perspective, like one that grew up in the 80s.
Yeah, it's because I like the thing of her dealing with, like, when she's going around asking, do you have that ringing? What's that ringing? Like, she doesn't understand that you can have a phone in your pocket, which is adorable. And I think it only works, it's because it's Jennifer Garner, who is adorable in this movie and really good. I mean, when she's kind of back in her parents' place, back in the wardrobe, trying to will herself out of her dream or whatever this thing is, but she's just, and nothing's going right. Like, she can't fix anything. I think that's, she makes those moments absolutely work. She, when she's giving the speech to Mark Ruffalo at the end, it's like, no, you're the one I should have been with. I'm screwed up and I love you. And then he goes, well, that's nice, but I'm getting married to someone else. And her absolute, which is trying to go, no, this is fine. And you can tell her she's completely heartbroken. And how she's able to kind of navigate these wild things of emotion, which 13-year-old girls have. We're very unpredictable. A teenage girl is very unpredictable, very loud. And because we're swinging from emotion to emotion to emotion, she does that really well. Everything's the best. Everything's the worst. And I think she plays that really, really well. I mean, in terms of rom-coms, it's usually the supporting actors that make the movie, the best friends, the bosses, anyone else who's kind of in that that kind of hemisphere of the movie, you latch onto them. And Judy Greer, Mark Ruffalo, and Andy Serkis are all great. But in this movie, it's Garner, and you need to, even though you don't believe what's happening, you need to believe her, and you do. She's a fantastic 13-year-old girl. I mean, when she dresses up for the first time, she's so proud of herself. It's
like, yeah, and she looks, like what a 13-year-old. Yeah, she bumps into Renee Olmsted, who at the time was just coming up, you know, and I would see on a great sitcom called Still Standing with Jamie Gertz and Mark Addy and several others too. But kind of an underrated show, actually. But this before she had really done any of that kind of stuff. And she's the neighbor girl that this real Jenna always ignores. But this Jenna, of course, is still 13. So that thinks that's her friend, you know? And so they have the whole sleepover later with all of her friends, and she's quoting them Pat Benatar lyrics. And it's just, but it's funny. And then I think that's also, there's that scene where her and Judy Greer are at the bar or whatever. And Judy Greer's like, that guy's giving you the eye. And she thinks it's the kid sitting over here with his mom or whatever. Yes. And I'm like, but that, I mean, like, oh, that's also kind of like, you're a little creepy, but it's also funny because Judy Greer makes the joke out of it. And I think you said something though about like the supporting cast. Like immediately when you said that, I thought about the supporting cast of Pretty Woman and Hector Elizondo, yes, and even Jason Alexander, who's such a creep in that movie. And
oh my, you need him all in the place. I can't even remember her name.
Laura San Giacomo. And
yes.
All of those people really ground the rest of that movie, and really any good rom-com, the supporting characters ground the movie. And you've really got the push and pull of the two people that are the two people that are really trying to vie for Jenna's interest in her life. You've got Lucy, played by Judy Greer, who that's who she would grow up to be, like that, the girl they got to play her. Like, kid casting is always tough, but like I've recently gotten hooked on the show Yellow Jackets, which, by the way, everybody who didn't tell me about that, what's up? Anyway, but
I apologize because that show is
it's bonkers, is what it is. But the kid casting they do to that, like next to the, I'm like, that's like uncanny, like how, at least on the show, how much they all kind of look alike and mimic each other. And it's a tricky thing to do, but the two girls that they got to play the counterparts here are so good, and hers is I mean, she's, what's funny is to watch this movie again and you see that young actress do things that then Judy Greer does the same thing later. You know, it's like she watched her dailies and said, okay, so she stands like this, she puts her hand on her hip, like she does the same movements, and she, and Judy Greer has such good snarky comic timing. You know, she's always good at that. And she's so good at kind of spitting out all of that mean girl dialogue, right? And
this is very Mean Girls, which came out like the year before, but then
right. Yeah. Like
if you can't beat them, join them. Yeah.
Her or Rachel McAdams, which it was meaner, you know, but she's an adult with actual like money. So technically meaner, but you know, she's so in the dream world that Jenna has for herself. And then you got Mark Ruffalo, who is this, he's kind of he's not really a nerd. He's kind of a, I don't know, alternative guy before there was such a thing in 1987. He would have been the kind of person that would, I mean, he's listening to the Talking Heads. He thinks the Clash are cool. He's not into, I mean, he calls Rick Springfield a bum. You know, he's not anything popular, right? So he's a hipster is what he is in 1987. And the fact that he grows up to be one, I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And he's the grounded part of Jenna's life. So like there's the city over there, but like we're from Jersey, we could just be, you know, normal people. And that's what he represents for her. It's the same thing like George Bailey, right? Like if I wasn't here, what would happen? And all these other things that would come and go, what would change? And it's a neat thing that this movie's trying to do to unravel for us. And I appreciate the fact that you call out Jennifer Garner, because it takes something special to act like a teenager and not be ridiculous. You know, like there's a little goofiness, but she pulls it off like so earnestly. That's the thing about her, is I think she's always very earnest.
No, she is absolutely earnest. And if I think she played it with a glint in her eye and that knowing glint that sometimes people do, I don't think this movie would work, because you have to believe that Jenna's woken up in Jennifer Garner's body and now has to kind of deal with everything in front of her, which you do, because Jennifer Garner is absolutely great. I mean, I love the scene when she's at the party. Not going that well, so she starts dancing to Thriller, and then it becomes kind of a hit because everyone likes that song. It's just this really kind of cool moment. She's just so happy, but she's just effervescent and happy and kind of wants to enjoy life when everyone around her is just like, oh, okay, we're adults, it sucks. She's like, but this is awesome. I do like Mark Ruffalo's role, because he's kind of the one person in the movie that keeps going, you do realize this is crazy. Everything you're saying is crazy right now. Like, she's very upfront of like, look, all I remember is I was 13. We were in the closet. I pushed you away. And the next thing I know, I wake up and there's a strange man in my apartment, which I am thankful that Jenna Rink, 30-year-old, does not sleep with anyone.
Right.
I'm like big. But yes, I'm kind of glad that they just kind of skirt over that.
Yeah.
Yes. but this one, they kind of skirt around it and go, no, even though she's a grown woman, she still has she's technically still a 13-year-old. So we'll just dart around that. And we're like, okay, good. But he's kind of, they go back into very quickly into their friendship they had when they were kids. Except I would say that I think the Mark Ruffalo is a little bit more relaxed. I mean, that house is an intense gift. Like, I was like, if my best friend gave me that gift, it was a boy, I'd be like, oh, even at 13, I'd be like, this is a lot. What? And Ethan, yeah, like, though the cutest thing, like, wow.
Yeah, like Jenna does not pick up on it. And that's the thing you got to know about the Jenna character is she's so self-obsessed with this idealized point of life. She doesn't realize what's right in front of her. And that's the thing is like the two powerful lessons of this movie. And I think they're great. Even though being an adult is complicated in some ways, it's not as complicated as you think or as that people make it out to be. Because truthfully, Jenna learns how to navigate this simply by showing up on time, paying attention, and asking good questions. If you can do those three things, you can pretty well navigate your way through life. Yeah. And that's what I like about that is that she's able to figure it out. So it kind of demystifies, like, you think you're going to learn all these things in the next 17 years. Really, you're just going to learn experience and how to navigate. You're going to do it wrong, and you got to do it wrong a few times. But you'll figure it out, and you'll pick it up. And the other thing is that even if being an adult is not as complicated as you want it to be, also pay attention to the people that are feeding positivity into you and not people who constantly put markers for you to be something else in your life. Because the only reason she gets the popular girls to come to the party and ultimately the kind of a throwaway, the popular jock guy who becomes a cab driver, Jim Gaffigan in a kind of a cameo, sort of gross, Planet Gross guy. The only reason she gets him is because she promises to do their homework. Right. You know, and it's kind of lost in there. But you see that the Jenna that we get to see sort of stumbling through life as a 30-year-old, she's not that person anymore, right? Or she, at least in this world, she says, I will not be that person. I'll be the person everybody's afraid of. And you watch her kind of walk through the office as 13-year-old Jenna when she's nice and nobody knows how to react to her because she's usually horrible to them.
Yeah. No, it's because I love her secretary. I didn't write down the actor's name, but she's the fact that she's constantly on the verge of tears because Jenna's obviously the worst to work for. And the fact that it is absolutely Jenna who is, because the whole thing is that this other magazine keeps scooping their ideas, like having J-Lo on the cover and all that kind of thing. And she's the one that's been doing it because she's going to go over and work for this. So she, again, it's that she kind of learns very early with the younger Lucy is that relationships are transactional. And you need, but when you're being transactional, you need to be the one who gets the upper hand. Like, if I'm going to throw a party and promise you to do my homework and you come, I then need to get something out of it, which Lucy does not get at the beginning. She gets tricked and she's humiliated and she doesn't like it. So from then she's learned, okay, well, I just need to be the biggest bitch. And I love the fact that the slow realization that the sweet 13-year-old has of, oh, I grew up to be a horrible person. And I don't like this. My parents don't like me. Even Lucy doesn't really like me. My boss likes me, but he doesn't really know me. Even who I thought was my best friend doesn't like me. So it's about her trying to navigate these relationships when no one actually likes her. And it's fascinating. That's fascinating. She's like, wait, but no. Oh, so no one actually likes me. Oh, this is not a good feeling.
Yeah, they're afraid of me, so they do what I say. But and when you're 13, you think, well, that's how you get people to respect you. You make them fear you, whatever, because that's your 13-year-old like television version of how, you know, good management skills work. And I think we all work for people that are like that. And none of us have good things to say about them. So, that's not really how I'll be honest with you. I've worked long enough now and they're like, most people are generally pretty decent. Like they really just want to do stuff and mostly want you to leave them alone and you to be left alone too. And so once you kind of figure that out, you can navigate the world of work, y'all. But what's neat is as a 13-year-old though, that's what I thought too. Like, oh yeah, the best managers are the strictest. The people that like, you walk in the door and everybody snaps their fingers and snaps too. And it's also like you talk about the ridiculous place all these people live. Like, of course, Jenna having the apartment she does is kind of legit because based on like what she does for a living, you could buy it a little bit. Mark Ruffalo lives in an entirely ridiculous place. But for a 13-year-old's wish fantasy, yes, because you know what you never see? You never see where the hockey player lives. Right, that she's supposedly dating, which that guy's hilarious. I don't know who he is, but I thought he was like a real athlete, but he's just a funny guy. And you never see where Judy Greer lives. You know, you don't know. They're just people that pop in and out because they're just imagination things in her mind.
Yeah, that is actually true. I didn't pick up on that, but you only really see the office, Jenna's apartment, and Maddie's apartment. Those are kind of the, and whenever she goes to a party or thing, but those are the main kind of locations. you don't see that, but they are very much this 13-year-old. I mean, even when I was a kid and imagined myself as an adult, it was living in an apartment like Mark Ruffalo, being a bohemian, but still having a 5-bedroom apartment in Greenwich Village. Which, even when I was watching Friends as a teenager, I'm like, how do they afford their apartments again? I've heard New York is expensive. So it was kind of this given that I thought New York apartments were huge. And then when you realize the reality, they're shoeboxes, because New York is a small place with a lot of people, like Hong Kong and certain parts of Japan and all that kind of thing. But yeah, I love, as soon as I saw his apartment, of course he lives in this apartment as a photographer.
Right. I mean, he's got the same kind of layout in his house, his apartment, that he probably had in his bedroom as a kid that Jenna would have seen or would have known. Like, it's almost the reflection of, again, her memories of it. But that's the thing, is when you realize that this movie is not trying to tell you this is what Jenna grows up to be and then she wishes herself back out of it, this is all her fantasy in her head anyway. And it's her sort of working through it. If you follow the movie that way, you're like, oh, so what Jenna gets by the magical 80s dust is she gets to become a time marker. She's not so much a time traveler, so she can't, you know, come and go at will. She can't Marty McFly it, but or even go through the links that he has to do it. But she does get to sort of astral project herself into this fantasy land to see what it's like and then bounce back out. Like, I think about one of my very favorite episodes of Buffy that's kind of a non-main episode, but it's one in season 3 where Cordelia's mad, and so she wishes that Buffy had never come to Sunnydale, and like the hell that episode breaks loose because of that, and everything that unravels. It's so well done. And it's the same kind of thing. It's just, you wish these impetuous things when you're a teenager, but if you really unravel them, you realize like, oh, wow, that's a pretty fateful choice. You also have to accept, though, I think as part of this, that the decisions you make when you're 13 affect you for the rest of your life. I don't know that that's entirely accurate, but for the purposes today, like I'll let it slide, because the movie lives in a world where we have to believe that to be able to go with it.
Yeah, and when you're 13 and you're a teenager, you kind of do. It's kind of this weird thing when you're in high school when they keep saying this is the most important exam of your life, and it is at that moment. But looking back, it was just to get through. They said that so you got through your exams, that you actually got through the schoolwork, that you took it seriously.
Right.
Which is a good thing, because otherwise, like, it's the whole, why am I learning this maths? When am I ever going to use this? It is important because it is going to affect your future. But what I think it does, it's just more affects the next few years, the more than anything else, because you're constantly changing, which was the big thing for me when I go to my 20s. I was like, wait, what? There's no set plan. I thought there was like a plan, and there's not. But when you're a teenager, you think there is, because adults seem, if they're good at kind of knowing the three things, like, you know, showing up on time, listening, asking good questions, and you can muddle through. You think adults have a plan, but they don't. They're just trying to turn up in time and just trying to listen. So it captures that 13-year-old mentality of, oh, I just want to grow up already. I don't want to have to be told what to do all the time. My mother is being patronizing, and kind of trying to steal these platitudes, but she was probably told when she was a kid, and it's very annoying. And I want to be in the cool group. So how do I do that? And everything's immediate, which is when you're a teenager, everything is so immediate. There is no, so it's interesting to have projector in the future, and then she's still got that mentality, but then she's slowly realizing that that's not, you know, as you said, she's working through things. It's like, do I want to be a mean girl, or do I want to, though the ending, I'm like, really? So you just stay with your high school, with your, not even high school yet, with your childhood boyfriend, you get married, and you stay in the, which she gets her dream house, like the one he built for her. So I get that. But I'm like, so what did you do in the interim? Like, did you go out to the city? Did you travel? Did you do all these things?
See, I have thoughts about that. We'll get to that as we get through it. But the way Jenna operates, and particularly Jennifer Garner, sort of bounces into this life, is there's some hilarious things that happen here. 80s nostalgia, or at least the MTV Sheened version of 80s nostalgia that Hollywood throws out there, is always like a delicate balance, right? Because these are kids from 1987. And I tried to think back to, because I was a teenager at that point, or I was a pre-teenager at that point. And I tried to think back, because I remember how big a deal Thriller was when that came out, and like the making of the, all of that, just the takeover of it. But I'll be honest with you, nobody I knew how to do the Thriller dance till I was like in high school and beyond. That dance lasted forever. So it's funny that she's like in, like we see her practicing, it's Chekhov's dance. She's practicing it at, before the birthday party, because I guess they were going to do the Thriller dance. And then her way to rescue the Poise magazine premiere party is to get the DJ to stop playing Euro trash music, Euro bomb music, and to actually play Thriller. And I'm like, so what Jenna does is she turned it into every white American wedding DJ thing. So
I was just going to say, the last wedding I was at, they played Thriller. Everyone got on the dance floor. Like, it's this weird, contagious thing. Even my partner, who does not dance, went up when Thriller started. So there's something about that song that has always lived in. It was kind of like the perfect, like the fact that she's into Rick Springfield. Like,
yeah,
Springfield. I think even the taxi driver
because it's Springsteen. Yeah, just it's supposed to show how uncool he is when he does that. But
that a kind of a pop figure that is very now more niche. If you remember him, not quite like what Maddie's into, like the Clash and Talking Heads, which has become much more kind of mainstream. Versus Thriller, which is just is a song that soundtracked every single wedding since it came out in like 1983.
Yeah, it's 83, 84 was that record. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that was early 80s, you know. So the fact that they're so still into it, I mean, I'm like, but I got to thinking about it, and I thought, well, you know what though, my brother's 5 years older than me, he had that LP and he was still listening to it at that point. Like, it, I mean, I think people have listened to that album since it existed. So they need something though to market with. You know, like, we have to have something to make this thing work. And what makes that scene work is Mark Ruffalo. I feel like he's just playing himself, like going, do you want me to do what? And like, he gets out on this floor, he's like, okay. And like, and then everybody else starts joining in. And then Andy Serkis goes in there and just hams it up, like the perfect zombie walk. And I'm like, of course he would know how to do that. And I love how Ruffalo bails, like, I'm supposed to be too cool for this, and I actually am. And so I'm leaving and just walked off the set. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it just plays so well that way. But I like it. And I know I'm putting a lot on the kind of characters Ruffalo has played outside of his Avengers world.
You can't help years. It now.
Yeah, you know, and I'm sort of in retrospect remembering that. But even at the time, I'm watching this like, there's no way that dude would ever get out. He don't care if that's his best friend in the whole world. He didn't get out there and do it that. Like, but I did think it was fun though that they throw us into that, because this movie has to have those moments. And you may think like that's just a throwaway moment, but I'm like, no. But in the wish fulfillment of a 13-year-old, that's fresh on her brain too. She just did it, you know, 10 minutes before this all starts. So yeah, that's what would work out. And again, that's why I say you have to watch this movie and accept the fact that you're watching a rom-com-y It's a Wonderful Life for a 13-year-old girl from 1987.
I did the same thing when I was a teenager, it wasn't exactly a Thriller, but it would be, say, Bohemian Rhapsody, where we would recreate the Wayne's World scene.
Right.
Even like a Backstreet Boys song, Backstreet's Back, we'll try and do the dance for that. I mean, that is kind of something teenage girls do. I mean, that's pretty much, from what I understand, 80% of TikTok is just people doing weird dances. So it's kind of just in when you're young, and if you are 13 and you just practiced your Thriller dance, or when you can do it at the party, you're going to nail it. That's her idea of what a party is. Mm-hmm. So of course she's going to go, well, we need to jazz things up, so let's do Thriller. Like, that is, right. It makes complete sense for what a 13-year-old girl would do. And because they chose the right song, everyone's going to go, actually, yes, I'm not too cool for this, because everyone has that memory of doing the goddamn dance at some point in your life.
Everyone has done that. And it's, while you think like, no, that's not the music the DJs played, is actually more like what you would get in the early 2000s in a club. So you know, we hadn't hit the key moments of what I call DJ culture quite yet in early 2000s. But I love that she banks into everybody else's nostalgia. Because again, from Jenna's point of view, this would make everybody else. And what I love is the way everyone reacts to, particularly Circus. You know, it's like, oh yes, you saved the day, you know, because that's how easy things work out in your head. When in reality, like that might actually work for a few minutes, but then like, what are you going to do for an encore? Because that song's 5.5 minutes long and it's over. So what do we do? But again, it's all built off this idea of wish fulfillment. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that with you because you've seen such an array of films, and particularly because the way your show is structured, it's sort of pulling threads that connect between two films and stuff like that. I was trying to think of other wish fulfillment films besides Big that have existed, and sort of how the lesson of that is almost always it never works. And I was trying to think of, is there a good example where the wish fulfillment actually is, yes, I got what I wanted and it's what I actually wanted for anybody? Because I couldn't think of one.
No, I mean, the moral of the story is that it always isn't going to work out, because I was thinking a lot of Happy Death Day. Probably more the sequel would be more ambiguous, because the first one is she's trapped in her own kind of trauma of and her own horribleness. And then she learns, okay, like the actual movie Groundhog Day, I have to learn how to be a better person to get out of this thing. But in the second one, she goes back and is in a parallel universe where her mother is alive. And that is the wish fulfillment. But then she realizes, oh, but wait, I've had all these years with a boy I've fallen in love with who's now dating my frenemy, best frenemy. I've got all these things now I've lost because I get this one thing. So which one do I choose? And that is kind of the interesting dilemma in that movie. It's like she has to make a choice of, oh, this is the one thing I've always wanted in my life since she passed away. I can't have it back. But because I get her, I have to lose everything else. And it's, but yeah, I don't think there's a wish fulfillment, or it's more the wish fulfillment in, say, in It's a Wonderful Life, is that you realize what you wanted was already there. It's like the Wizard of Oz. It's like, you know, all she wants to do is go home when she's finally over the rainbow. George Bailey, even though he's always wanted this other life where he could travel and do all these things, the life he has is actually going to be better than anything else he wished for, because Donna Reed's waiting for him at home. It's that kind of thing more than anything else. And I think that's always the moral of that kind of structure. It's be careful what you wish for, because it could come true. Home Alone is another good example. Kevin finally gets rid of his family and then realizes, oh, wait, I actually do need, I'm 10. I shouldn't be the self-sufficient. And I kind of do like my family. They annoy me, but I do want them for Christmas. It's always that kind of thing. It's always you have to lose something to get what you want. And is it actually worth it? The thing is where I'm coming to.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right. And that's the thing is with most wish fantasy movies, is it's not just your life that gets changed. It's everybody else around you. And that's what's cool to watch Jenna here, is when she becomes aware of the ripple effects of her choices to be 30, flirty, and thriving, you know, what that means for everybody else around her. And particularly like what Matt's life is like, because even though he's pretty successful, I mean, he's, you know, he's doing his thing, he's getting married to somebody who clearly likes him, but you can tell he's just kind of like, I don't really want to move to Chicago, but I will. You know, we've all known that person, right?
I've been in this relationship for this long, I might as well continue it.
Right. Yeah. I'm just kind of, well, okay, might as well. Right. We're here at this point. Right. Yeah. And that's, she sees like, I could have been like, I was his dream girl, you know, and it really, he should have been my dream guy, because we were perfect for each other, all this stuff. And it's, even though it's kind of simple, that's the cool lesson of this, is sort of when Jenna becomes aware of the fact that, oh, I, this is all a fantasy. Like, that's what's neat, is that by the beginning of the third act, she realizes this is a fantasy in which I'm in control. So I'm going to try to make it the fantasy that I didn't wish for necessarily, but the one that now I knew want. And it's not until she realizes, oh, I have to completely reset the time dial to be able to get back to where I was to make it what I want. And I like that though, because the simple way we've been through is that, oh, she somehow or another unravels Lucy's plan to steal her ideas, and they get the big, you know, promotion at the magazine, and her and Matt run off together, and yay, you know. But no, she has to go back to when she's 13 to do all the little stuff to lead up to the life she wants, rather than just snapping her fingers on it. And I appreciate the movie for that, because a cheaper movie would have just taken the straight line instead of making her work all the way back around for it.
Exactly. And I also like the fact that once Lucy does the betrayal, you're kind of on her side. Well, except for what she does to Maddie. That's horrible. Like, she basically says, well, you know, Jenna doesn't really like you. You're not that cool. But can we have your the release for your photos? Because I kind of need them.
Right.
But the fact that she's not the one who has been betraying the magazine, she's not committing any espionage, I think is probably the corporate espionage. And then suddenly turns on Gemma, you're kind of like, actually, yeah, because Gemma's been really shitty and now she's got a shitty friend and now the shitty friend's turned on her. Are you really surprised by that? And I'm like, yeah, you go, Judy. You saw what she was doing and you decided to save yourself. It's incredibly selfish.
Yeah, but that's who she is. Like, that's the thing. Like, Lucy is.
She's never been anything else.
Well, and again, in Jenna's head, that's what she always is. And she knows she's that. And so the fact that she grows up to be that, it's a really great moment for Judy Greer when she's kind of cleaning out the office and going like, I don't blame you. I mean, I wish I had thought of it. It's a great idea. But now I'm going to steal it and do it for myself. So thanks a lot. But I love that she lays that out for her, you know, as the Bond villain of the rom-com would be, you know, as she is. And I'm, you know, and of course, she had the final straw was that she betrayed, you know, Matt and oh, I can't have that, you know, or whatever. But
that was the main thing when she's like going against Jenna. I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. I might have done something. I'd actually not something similar, but I can understand when she goes, well, you were doing this, so why are you getting upset? It's a great idea. I wish I'd thought of it. Now I'm doing it, like, just because you're obviously not going to finish it. But what she does to Matt is kind of shitty. Like, that's like, That's cruel because Matt's been nothing but nice.
Right.
Even does the Thriller dance when he's obviously uncomfortable.
But I love though too. Like, I got such a kick out of when they're doing their presentations. Cause I think we've all sat in like the work presentation where the one person is, they're so into their idea, but it is the so complete wrong headed thing to do. And like, she's doing, we're going to create fashion suicide. I mean, just this insane, ultra dark, almost like gothic 2000s, thing. And I love how Jenna comes in and goes like, who are all these people? I don't know any of these people. Let's have real people. And what's funny about that is like, oh yeah, that's, I would buy that magazine. Nobody buys that. Okay. That's why they still do all the crappy stuff that, you know, gives people image problems and things today. But I love that they're calling it out. Like, she realizes like, why am I looking up to these people? I don't know who any of these people are. And it's the same things her mother said to her. It's like, those aren't real people, honey. Those are models. Yeah, and
it's,
I love
like
that.
Zoolander when Will Ferrell's idea is like homeless fashion.
Yes.
Like the dumbest thing ever. But I think in the early 2000s there was less like derelict trend, which is like what Judy Greer is like proposing. I'm like going, no, that was actually going around in the early 2000s, if I remember correctly. It was like this like a very haute couture, like which is so wrong-headed. Just like, really? That's what you- okay, fine. But yeah, that was actually kind of going around at that time. It was like these models were so, I mean, you think they were so thin and so kind of not real, especially in the early 2000s. I think it's changing more just because we have more of a diverse kind of, the internet's made it more diverse, so you can have slightly more body types. It's not perfect by any stretch of the means, but in the early 2000s, if you weren't like almost to the point where people were like going, baby, I think there's a problem, you couldn't be a model. And that was so dangerous. And I think with the fact that they're calling that out, like, hey, let's just use real people and have like an 80s nostalgic thing again, which was kind of in the air. But no, the reality was they would have gone with Judy's idea. Like, that's
what's funny though is that you've got two, and Jennifer Garner and Judy Greer are both very beautiful women. So what I'm going to say is going to sound wrong for a minute, but they are non-conventional looking leading ladies, you know, like they look like real people that you might know. Like, Judy Greer in particular looks like people you know. Like,
she's
and Jennifer Garner looks like that too, you know.
She's not going to be put on a magazine cover in 2002. She will be now, because I was just watching the first episode of The White House Plumbers, and she plays the wife of Justin Theroux, who's being extra Theroux in this. I'm not sure if I entirely like it, because I'm like going, you and Woody are doing a thing, and I'm not entirely sure I like this. But she's just there and she just reads the vibe of the acting and just goes, I'm just going to match it and I'm going to do it well. And she's always done that. She's always been insanely beautiful. And she always knows how to just kind of raise a scene that little bit by just kind of reading the thing. And she does it in this movie. And I really like her. But yeah, it's a shame that in the 2000s, they would never have put. I think Jennifer Garner got on a bit because she was an alias and she was more.
Like you said, she was this action star, you know.
Yeah, so she's
this athletic, you know, version of that. And I'm glad that we've come to a point in the day where we've got more broader representation of what real people look like, and men, women, you know, all in between.
We're not
perfect, but we're more broad. But putting myself back in the 2000s mindset, and also remembering this is what a 13-year-old in 1987 thinks 2004 is going to look like. You know,
yeah.
But she doesn't know what cell phones are. She doesn't understand the internet. She where anything is. You know, like she doesn't understand that pina coladas are loaded with a lot of alcohol. Like, you know, she has no idea. Which, like, clearly the bar was like, there's something wrong with that lady. Just don't put anything in it. Like, you know, like she'll never know. Like, clearly she's not well. Because if a 13-year-old had hit as many as she did, I did get a kick at, like, the running gag is that she keeps throwing her food around and keeps hitting that one guy in the face, you know, like the whole bar, like the Thriller does. It's just a little throwaway thing, but I'm like, that's kind of a cute thing that these movies always have. You gotta have something like that. I think there's a great the opening bit at the Wayne Mansion in Tim Burton's Batman. Michael Keaton is constantly laying a glass down and Michael is running behind him to pick it up, and it's just, you know, all kinds of just little pratfalls. And I appreciate that kind of stuff, though, because again, in a lesser movie, that gets lost. But all those little, like, behind things make it memorable, make it fun. And again, we're watching a 13-year-old. That's what they do. Like, I have 13-year-old nieces and nephews, and that's exactly how they do. They're just like, I'm done with that. Toss it. Yeah. I'm like, there's a trash can like 2 feet from you. Like, come on, you know. But it.
Yeah, no, I've been watching Succession a little bit, and one thing that really, which I think is completely on purpose. Nothing in that show is by accident. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they're constantly surrounded by food, but it's only Cousin Greg who eats.
Yeah.
And if any of the other characters want to eat, they'll get instantly shamed for it. Like, it's like, what are you eating, canapés right now? Because there's this kind of excessive wealth and they don't have to think about anything.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not that concerned. Karen Culkin sits in a chair. He doesn't sit, he just kind of loafs in because he's always knows there's always going to be something be that. When you're 13, those guys haven't grown out of it because they never had to have any responsibility. In adults, you do kind of tend to grow out of it, but then you just leave things because you're done with that, and then you're done with it. There's no, why would you think about it?
Well, yeah. Again, there's somebody there to pick it up for you. There's your parents. Yes. There's somebody, and that's the fun part of watching this arc of this character is she doesn't really become a 30-year-old because, like, there's parts of Big where, like, Tom Hanks becomes a pretty legit adult for a while.
He
kind of gets it, which is funny to watch him do, but this Jenna never really changes who she is. She's still that 13-year-old trapped in this sort of new world. And she figures out when she goes back and visits with her parents, and she kind of gets more of her story about why she changed, why she did what she did, mm-hmm. and all the things that, like, they kind of fill in the gaps of how do you get to where you are? You know, you just sort of seemed always driven toward one thing, and it was this, and you know, it was all she was obsessed with. And she realizes, like, well, her first mistake is like, well, okay, I can make the life now the way that it ought to be instead of the way that I dreamed of it. And it's not until everything blows up with the magazine, she, you know, does the hilarious cab ride, gets back to Jersey to catch Matt at his house before he gets married, to tell him, you know, God, it should have been you. I should have been there. And he tells her, like, I can't, you know, like, it's been great, sure, but this is real life and we can't just do that. You know, I'm happy with Wendy or whatever her name is. And I love it when
he says her family is downstairs.
Right. This, like, he's got to let people down. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not about you. It's mm-hmm. I've got her family downstairs so that I have responsibilities. And
right.
Jenna doesn't really, I mean, she pushes her back to being a 13-year-old as soon as responsibilities start coming up again, because you're right, she's still a kid. So she never actually learns how to be an adult. She just goes, okay, I don't like this. This fantasy's not working out the way I want. Okay, I'm going to. And the whole third act is her trying to get back to being a kid.
Well, I think it's in that moment, though, is when she decides, like, wait a minute, though. What I've been trying to do is make this fantasy life into the life that I really should be leading, when it is a fantasy. I'm aware it's a fantasy. It's like when you're having a really intense dream. If the part of your brain gets triggered enough to go, like, I realize this is not real, and
this
you kind of wake yourself out of it.
I know that. Yes.
yeah. And we hope we have that right when you're in a really good, but it's that self-aware moment when you realize that, like, we're in control. I'm still in control of this. There's a moment in the book sphere, not so well done in the movie, sadly, because I want that to be good. And I keep watching it, hoping it will be, but it's just not. But in the book sphere, when they all become aware that they are in control of the manifestations, as it were, and when they collectively figure that out, or at least you think they do in the book, it's a neat power moment. And there's something when Jenna says to him, because it's really the first unselfish thing she says in the movie, is that,
yes,
I just want you to be happy, and you deserve to be happy, and you're right. And it's just when she realizes that, like, in this fantasy, in this life, in this timeline or whatever it is, you deserve to be with her and be happy, and I need to go away. But I can have this if I just go back and make a different choice. And that's kind of the fun moral quandary of the movie. Because on one level, I kind of don't want Jenna to get him because she doesn't deserve him. At least that timeline, Jenna doesn't. But the 13-year-old may. Not. You know, if she could, if you could go back and make that choice, or if you could see forward enough to know, oh, that would be a bad choice. Yeah, you might go back and do it differently.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole thing with a wish fulfillment movie, is that you learn from your mistakes and you go and live your life differently. And that's every single movie that has kind of that structure. That's kind of the end point. I can't think of a movie where it'd be hilarious, because there would be no arc. When you get what you want, you do what you want, you stay in the fantasy and everything's fine. Like, there's no, it's kind of like the Christmas movie. There has to be kind of the moment of, oh, it's family that is important. That is what is actually, that all the other stuff, this is what's important, which is why you see that in so many Christmas movies, because that kind of society moral kind of thing about the family structure, which I could get into about the family structure, which this does lean into, but that's kind of what the story arc is. That's what the movie's trying to do. And it still allows you to live in the fantasy of living in New York, being 30, flirty and thriving. Not hard, easy to say. And you still get the fantasy of it from a child's point of view, but then the realization of, actually, I'm now a terrible person who will throw it. I have no actual strong relationships, so I'm completely isolated. And even my parents have had enough of me. So she's not able to go home. I mean, that scene when I think her dad walks into her in the wardrobe, which is trying to wish herself back, and she can't do it. But when she talks to her mother, it's like, those are the heartbreaking points of the movie, because she's realizing that she can't necessarily go to her parents for help anymore. And that's kind of the first point where she goes, I may have made a huge mistake with all my choices.
Yeah.
All the choices that I think that I want to make in the future.
And I mean, I think there are a few lines that her parents drop on her too, about, like, as you get older, you'll realize, like, the weight of your decisions, but don't wish your life away until you live it, you know. And so I kind of think it's neat that they don't show us. I mean, there's like a few pictures where they've sort of stages of Jenna and Maddie's life together. But I love that they don't show us all of it, because what you realize is that Jenna learns that, like, okay, I'm going to have to go and, like, live this a piece at a time, and I'm not going to worry about all this other stuff, because I need to just pay attention to what's in front of me. Like, that's the great lesson. And you hope she, I mean, obviously she stuck with it, right? Because that's the end of the movie. But I think that's neat though, because, like we talked about, every decision she's made is a very selfish one until that moment when she realizes, like, okay, I need to think about somebody else's happiness, because in this timeline, I don't make all the rules. And if I do, they're horrible for everybody. So I need to let this go and then go back and live my life and just take it as it comes and see what happens and not get caught up in all the stuff.
Exactly. Like, she's starting to realize that she affects others. And when you're 13, you do not think that. That is not. You're 13. You're a very self-obsessed creature that doesn't put your things away because someone else is going to do it. And your brain is changing and all these things are sort of happening. So you don't necessarily think about how you're affecting others. When you're an adult, that's when you should be realizing that your choices will affect other people, that you are not kind of a monolith on your own. You live in a society, you have a people around you who you care about, and that you actually want to, who you want them to be happy outside of what you're doing. So it's kind of that lesson, I think, that hopefully a lot of adults learn.
Right.
Not always, unfortunately. But that is, I think, the crux of the movie. And that is why the movie is so charming and why Jennifer Garner is so good, because she captures that, especially when she's that speech. She's doing the whole big speech of I love you. And the fact that she does the typical I need to run to the wedding to stop it, which has happened so many times in rom-coms. And Mark Ruffalo just turns to her and goes, no, I'm getting married today. I've made my choice.
Right.
So this is the choice I'm making, and you just need to accept that choice. And the fact that she realizes that she has to accept that choice and then kind of realize that she doesn't necessarily have control over everything in this timeline or any time. Like, she's just got to, as you said, look at what is in front of her and just kind of deal with that, not worry about what's going to happen when she's 30 or looking at magazines and going, why can't I be that, when no one is ever, even those models don't look like that in real life.
So she's given the gift that most time travelers, it messes them up if you go back before you actually leap or leave. Right. But in her case, because she's been transported more than time traveled, she goes back to the moment where Matt tries to open the door for her. And that time she's like, finally, and so she realizes where she is, and she blows off Judy Greer's character, which is hilarious on the steps, and then they run off together, and the rest is history. And I like that, though. I mean, it's the sweet, earnest ending of the movie that I think we've earned and deserved. Even though I would have been fine if Jenna walked out the door, he gets married in the background, and she goes off to, like, we don't know what happens to her. She just goes off to the world wiser. Mm. We don't want that, though. We want her to go back and get everything. And I'm okay with it. I think the movie earns that sweet ending, because that other thing is the season three of Picket Fences or something like that. Like, it's not what this movie is built to be. And I mean, it's her George Bailey running through the streets moment, that's what she gets at the end. And I think we've got it. I mean, it makes it fun. And again, we both call it out, but it is, a lot of it is on Jennifer Garner. And I know we've talked a lot about the supporting cast, but she is fantastic in this and sort of building those emotional arcs and not being too lost in it. And that's what makes it so much fun.
Yeah. Even if I don't love the ending, just because I'm being very judgy of her marrying Mark, boy, marrying her childhood sweetheart and staying in New Jersey. But that's just me. But I love the fact that you can tell that she's actually more mature in that moment. You can tell that she's an actual adult.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's gotten married, she's lived her life, and now she's an actual adult living an adult life and having responsibilities. Like, they've obviously moved into a new house. So you do get that sense at the end that she's gotten the life she wanted, but now she's adult enough to actually do it.
Right. Yeah. And they're doing real adult things. They're moving a couch in together. They're moving boxes again. Many times my wife and I have moved. Sometimes just sit down on the couch and laugh and just, go like, what are we doing?
I'm so tired right now.
Yeah. And I love it. But before, cell phone cameras took over the world, like, he's got to pull out the little, like, portable camera to take pictures of them together, every 5 minutes. But I'm like, that's what, I mean, I had friends that did that. I've never been a big picture taking person, but I knew people that did that and have family members that are into that kind of thing. So it fit the moment at the time. The problem with the movies that were made in the 2000s is that there was no way you're ever going to keep up with all the technology changes that were happening during the time period. So they're always going to feel a little dated, but it's kind of in a quaint way. It's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Looking back now at a 2004 movie, which was next year is 20 years old, I can look at the fact that he's constantly taking selfies with an actual camera, or the fact that they've got little flip phones, or little Nokias, like, going, I remember those.
Yes,
it does get very nostalgic.
Yeah, yeah. This movie plays on nostalgia from two decades at the same time.
Yes, so.
But does it entirely work? It's time for final thoughts, recommendations, and popcorn ratings. So, Lindsay, please tell us yours for 13 going on 30.
I'm going to go for a medium bucket of popcorn with a lot of butter, because I do like this movie. I don't love it. But I think there is so many good things about it that I could just be happy with just a medium bucket with putting a lot of butter on it.
Yeah, I think this is a perfect matinee medium popcorn.
It's
just like I said in the beginning, it's just an easy movie. It comes in easy. It doesn't ask a lot, and it'll just go out easy. But I give it that extra butter and that sort of, like, it's well popped. It's well done medium matinee. fun because this movie realizes what it is, and it also the actors in it elevate it. And I think they knew we're in a time travel movie, but we're not going to talk about it, and we're not going to make it a time travel sci-fi movie. But like, what if Philip K. Dick didn't obsess about all the awful things in life and actually wrote a rom-com one day? And that's that's sort of what this movie does. And I credit this movie for that, and I credit its lasting power because it does speak to some very real things about you don't need to wish your life away. Like just it'll come in. It'll come eventually. Enjoy it where you are. Try to be aware of where you go and don't take everything so seriously all the time because it causes you to do your work presentations like fashion suicide, which no one should ever do. So I'm with you. It's a good media popcorn and a good time. Lindsay, it has been a blast talking about this movie with you. Please tell folks again how they can follow you and follow all the great things going on at Schlock and All.
Schlock and All is, I think, on mostly all the apps. I think it's very, very easy to track down. If you want to follow me, it's Schlock and All, one on Twitter and Instagram, and Reading Beak also on Twitter, where I talk about too many movies. But no, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Great time, and we'll definitely have to have you on again. Folks, thanks for listening to this episode of Filmstrip. You can follow the happenings of the show by going to filmstrippodcast.com. That'll take you to all of our distribution sites. Have also followed the show's social media at Filmstrip Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all the other ones. That's mostly Ron running that kind of stuff, but every now and then I'll pop in. And of course, if you go and subscribe to the show on Apple, Google, Spotify, whatever, you'll find our incredible back catalog, 340 plus episodes now, spanning over 13 years. Something in there for everybody. We appreciate your support. So until next time, for Lindsay from Schlock and All, I'm Jay. Thank you for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.